the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 380 premium for Thursday, February 9th, 2012. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab premium. I think you all know why you're here, but just in case, maybe for a refresher, John, we should tell them that we have you send in your questions. We have you send in your tips. We try to answer your questions to the best of our ability and sometimes reach out to the community. In fact, the community is always open to comment on anything we say. And we sometimes provide tips of our own. And then we like to talk about cool stuff found. And one last thing, right here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And right here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
There he is, ladies and gentlemen, John F. Braun. Here we are again. And there you are, our loyal, valued premium listeners, premium subscribers. Something that is immensely humbling to us both here. So thank you very much. I guess we should get moving. Feels like the pace is already kind of slower than usual, huh?
I heard you have a sip of tea or something, so.
Oh, you did hear me. I know. Usually, you know, I have the microphone aimed sideways. So, like, the mic is, I should take a picture and post it. I'm not talking directly into it. I'm actually talking across the front of the microphone. But what's nice about that is I don't get any pops. Or I don't get as many pops because I'm not talking into it. And then I also can easily get off axis to take a sip of tea. Of course, that time I went directly in front of the microphone and had a sip of tea. So my apologies to both you, John, and of course, collectively, all of our listeners.
That's okay. Well, I avoid that. I just get an IV with a gin and tonic going. So
that's a good idea.
It avoids that slurping sound.
You got to watch that quinine.
You know, quinine, I learned this, and then if you put a black light to it, apparently it fluoresces.
It does.
I just saw this one day online, and it's really freaky. I mean, it glows a nice UV. All right.
That's how we test you at the end of the night, like at Macworld Expo, for to see what you had. We just shine a black light on you, and if you glow, then we know.
Well, I think if anyone who was at Cirque du Mac, I think if you shined a UV light on people, there'd be a lot of people. Everybody was glowing.
That's good. Glowing is everyone. Good thing. Yeah. I never, this year I did have a beer at Cirque du Mac. I think I had two by the time the night was over, but I rarely actually get to enjoy. In fact, I had to wait in line for a beer at the bar. And one guy's like, "This is crazy. Why are you waiting in line?" I'm like, it doesn't matter. It's fine.
Hey, you're high energy enough, man.
Right.
I mean, you're already a kind of a basket case with all the adrenaline and up on stage and everything like that. You're a high energy type of guy, Dave.
I am. I know. That's how I roll. And I stay away from caffeine, but, hey, that's how it goes. I have a prediction that we are going to have audio issues in this show. We already had one set of them during a pre-show, but I just have this feeling like it's just not going to work out. But you're recording on your end, right, John?
Absolutely. And I'm looking at the Skype stats. No packet loss. I'm seeing send packet loss. Uh-oh. And it went away. Huh.
It knew you were looking at it. All right, let's get to Robbie's question. We have a couple of questions here about iTunes libraries and even a tip. So we'll start with Robbie and see where we go. Robbie writes, "I have my iTunes media libraries, etc., on an external drive that gets shared between my Mac Pro and my MacBook Pro. I have had this particular setup for years with no problems. Today, though, when I open iTunes on the MacBook Pro, everything is just as I left it. Music library, playlists, TV shows, movies, everything is just right. I quit iTunes, I move the external drive to the Mac Pro, and when I open iTunes, there is no media, music, playlist, nothing. The iTunes library file and iTunes XML file reside on the external hard drive as well. The timestamp of both files updated when I opened iTunes on the MacBook Pro first. If on the MacBook Pro, I right-click on the iTunes library.itl file on the external drive, iTunes opens and everything is good. If I try that process on the Mac Pro, iTunes opens and there is no media, playlist, music, movies, etc. How can the library be borked? I've never seen or heard of anything like this before." Okay, so in iTunes, it depends on how you have your iTunes library because it configured, because you can go into iTunes and you go in and iTunes preferences and advanced, I believe you can set the iTunes media folder location. And of course you can set that to an external drive, but that moves all your media, your podcasts, your videos, your TV, your movies, and of course all your music files all out to that drive. But your iTunes library file, the thing that knows what you have, keeps track of what you have, organizes all your playlists and stores all that stuff, that's actually stored in your home music iTunes folder. So I'm not sure how you're doing this, Robbie, if you set up symbolic links or what, but my guess is that iTunes on your Mac Pro is looking in your home music iTunes folder for its library files. And of course it didn't find them. So it started from scratch. But John, I'm hoping you have some thoughts on this, John.
You bet I do, brother.
All right.
Now, the other thing. All right. So you brought up a valid point with the advanced and iTunes media folder location. And that's certainly one important piece of information. The other is, and this is in a support article, and, you know, I'm still getting the same bizarre behavior, but I think I see what Apple's doing, Dave.
Okay.
Because I found an article. Now, of course, when I tried to bring it up, and a lot of you probably run into this because we link to these in the lovingly handcrafted show notes, which I still have to get to the ones for the last episode. Anyways, how to open an alternate iTunes library file or create a new one. Now, number one, I noticed this article has a different layout, but it also covers how to do this in both Windows and the Mac. So it looks like Apple is revamping their support article database. What I'm wondering, Dave, and I think we've discussed this in the past, and I think this is accurate, is so. Again, there's that directory, the iTunes media folder location, which, as you pointed out, contains these XML and ITL files. But I believe those are set. So depending on what platform you're on, you hold down a certain key when you launch iTunes, and you can either create a new library or choose a different library. And as far as I know, that's the first library that iTunes is going to look for. So I'm wondering if you want to repeat that operation and just make sure on both computers that you are, in fact, choosing that the library that it thinks it should be going to is the external one.
Oh, you know what could have happened is if he launched iTunes without the external drive connected, it may have defaulted to the default location and then not gone back. Oh, that's interesting.
That's what occurred to me when I read over this.
Yeah.
So relinking to him, I think, but I thought,
so you do this, maybe it gives up now. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, it depends. Yeah. So on the Mac, you hold down option on, we don't care about the Windows version. Oh.
Not as
you hold down option and you will get a box that will say, okay, choose library, create library, or quit. So of course you say choose library and then you point use the file browser and you point to the library that you'd like to load, which could be on an external drive.
I'm
wondering if what's happening, well, it should remember it, but I'm wondering is if it doesn't find it, does it default to?
Yeah, I bet it does.
Okay. Maybe that could be it. If I always thought that it would keep trying unless you intentionally chose a different one, it would keep trying. It would first look where it thinks it should be. And then if not, then it would default to a blank one, I guess.
Right. Oh. Right. Right. Huh. Well, we'll have to test, or Robbie will test and get back to us. But I bet you're onto something there, John. I bet that's it. Yeah. All right. Ready to move on?
Yes.
Awesome. So sticking in the similar vein here, Ralph, I wonder if we should share Daniel's tip first. Well, let's talk about Ralph here. Ralph says, I have one iTunes account, which I access with multiple Macs and iOS devices. When I'm at home, I sync both my iPhone 4S and my second gen iPod Touch to one iTunes account through my Mac. When I'm away from home, which is about 4 or 5 months of the year, I sync to the same iTunes account through my 15-inch MacBook Pro. My question is around the transition from one Mac to another. When I prepare to hit the road, I update my MacBook Pro to replicate all iTunes content on my iMac so that I have all my apps, TV shows, etc., exactly the same on both Macs, probably using something similar to what Robbie's doing here, where he's syncing that library folder and files. iTunes recognizes the host machine is different and wants to scrub the content of the iOS device in preparation for syncing the content to the new machine. I then go through the laborious process of redownloading all my apps, music, etc. from my computer to my iOS device. When I return home, I have to do the whole process over again in reverse. Is there an easy way to merge rather than replace when changing the host Mac used to sync iOS devices to iTunes? I hear snapping noises. Is that you, John?
I was more clucking.
Oh, okay. Well, Mr. Cluckmeister, go! Take it.
Yet again, a couple of articles here that I think will solve this problem. And I think really? The key to this, well, yes. So I found an article, which I think applies. Using iPhone, iPad, or iPod with multiple computers. Does that sound like the thing, what we want to do here?
Sort of, yeah. I'm curious where you're going with this. So yeah, go.
Okay, well, and actually I found two articles, and I think you got to look at both of these to do what you want. So there's the one that I just mentioned, which is using a device with multiple computers. And then there's another one here, which they reference, which is manually managing content. So I think what's happening is that the case that I think Apple likes, and it makes life easy if you follow this, is to have one iTunes library go to one device. I think that's an assumption that I think they make, and I think they like just to sell computers and devices. But if you want to go out of that paradigm, then you have to, I think, look at these articles and consider manually managing things so that a device is not tied to a library. Right?
Yeah. That. But the only thing that sucks about that is playlists and all of that don't automatically get put out there.
Right.
So, okay. So, yeah, right. iTunes, as we know it, is not built to sync this way. However, I'm in a similar situation in that sometimes I travel and sometimes I'm at home. And instead of going through what Ralph's talking about, John, I just have kind of given up on the concept of syncing while I'm out. And so I do not sync with my MacBook Air or my portable while I'm out. And that's been okay, but you know, it stinks wanting to get, you know, if I want to get files from my Mac to my iOS device in, you know, in that way, I can't. But lately that has changed. And the reason it's changed is with iTunes Match and iCloud. I can back up my iOS device to the cloud. And now not only does iTunes Match let me sync my music library to my music library in the cloud, which is managed by my iMac here in the office, but I can also set up my MacBook Air to sync to iTunes Match. And now everything is the same. So while I'm not plugging in, I am still syncing all of my stuff wireless, but it's also over the network to iTunes Match. And it sort of solves this problem in a different way. And it does require kind of a paradigm shift for you and $25 a year, because that's what Apple will get for you signing up for iTunes Match. But it really makes that whole process simpler, because you just no longer is your iOS device married to a computer in that way. I mean, it still is. You still can do the wireless syncing and it will be married in that sense, but not for your music library. So maybe that. Maybe that doesn't. I don't know. It's worth trying it. Might be enough for you, Ralph. And then we have Daniel. And Daniel noticed something, very interesting. He said, I found a cool thing this evening. You can actually sync an iDevice with more than one library concurrently, which is what you were talking about, John. He says, I believe this is strictly on a content type basis. For example, I have my main computer, a MacBook. I also have a Windows machine that is always on, a server of sorts. I want to have the always on computer sync podcasts because they'll stay up to date. All my other content can remain syncing with my MacBook. I don't believe you can mix and match within a content type, i.e. five artists from one computer and four artists from another. Attempting this results in a warning about replacing content that we've talked about. It says, I'm not certain how much of this functionality is dependent on iOS 5, iCloud, or iTunes Match. I've only attempted this with iOS 5 and iTunes Match. But what he's pointed out is that, and you have been able to do this for quite some time, as you mentioned, John, but it also works wirelessly. So when you're doing wireless syncing, which is new in iOS 5, you can wirelessly sync your movies to one computer and your music with another if you're not using iTunes Match. And if you are, then of course it's a little bit different with regards to music. But certainly apps and photos and podcasts and all that can be switched from computer to, you know, you can split them and have one come from one computer and one type and another type come from another. So that's pretty cool. Hadn't noticed that before. Good stuff, Mr. Braun.
I'll try it.
All right. You have not signed up for iTunes Match. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. I am pleasantly surprised with it, with how well it's working. It just kind of works with some, you know, funky exceptions every now and then. I'm curious if anybody's run into this. If you start downloading something over 3G and then stop it, oftentimes you cannot restart that download until you get to a Wi-Fi network, which is really weird. The track will show up in there, but you can't play it and you can't tell it to re-download until you get to Wi-Fi and then it comes in fine. So I've experienced that, and I think at least one other listener has too. So there you go. Do you think you're going to sign up for it, John?
I don't think so.
All right.
No, I mean, I got all my music on the Mini, and I sync it all with an iPod Touch that I have.
Yep.
And that's really, really it. The one thing I do want to dabble with, I looked at it briefly, but, you know, Amazon has their cloud drive, and
yeah,
I have bought MP3s from Amazon, and I guess if you buy MP3s from them, they allow free storage. Or if you buy music from them, they'll give you the MP3s for free without taking up any cloud storage space.
That's right.
And I assume they offer a iPhone or iDevice app to let you play that.
No, I don't think they do. I think that's one of the weaknesses of that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no, unless something has changed, there is no way to access the Amazon cloud from your iOS device other than, you know, going through the browser, and that's no fun.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. You're clucking again. This is new for you.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm clucking.
All right.
I was at the beach and I saw a lot of ducks. I guess some were rubbed off of me.
Nice. like water off a duck's back. Okay. Joe writes, guys, I'm having trouble with time zones when I travel, so I must have something set incorrectly. Here's the scenario. I have a meeting set at 8:30 a.m. San Francisco time, but the meeting is displayed on the calendar at 10:30 a.m. I have date and time set to set automatically on, and time zone is now set for Cupertino, where I am now. When I turn automatically to off, the time zone reverts to Chicago, which is the time zone of my hometown in Milwaukee. How do I set the iPhone so that my calendar times stay local to the time zone in which they will appear when I travel? Okay. Yeah. So this is something, you know, we talked about this, John, in a Mac Geek Gab a long time ago, because we were at Macworld Expo, and I think it was right after, it was right after the iPhone came out or something. Anyway, we've been through this. But it's not straightforward. So there's two things you need to do to get your calendar to display events in there at the correct time, regardless of what time zone you're in. And when I say that, I mean that if you're putting things in, like, let's say I'm here on the East Coast. If I say that I have a meeting that's at 1 p.m. Eastern time, I know that meeting is going to be at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And so if I fly from, New Hampshire or Boston rather to San Francisco, I want that to then show up at 10 o'clock on my calendar. I want the times to be universally correct. So assuming you're doing things that way, what you need to do is the following. On your iOS devices, if you have more than one, go into settings, go into general, go into date and time, and as Joe points out, you have set automatically turned on. What this setting does is it sets your time zone based on what the cell network tells your phone that it should be set to, or location services if you're doing it that way. So that's getting your time zone automatically. That's step one. And that's really handy because, you know, when you turn on your phone as the plane's taxiing, it gets a new time and everything's happy. Then, and this is the trick, back to settings, go to mail, contacts, and calendars, and go to time zone support, which is way, way down almost at the bottom. And this is where it's going to be strange. You're going to set time zone support to off. And this is totally not intuitive to me, John. I don't know how you feel about it, but the description in gray text below it is correct. And the description says, when time zone support is off, events will display according to the time zone of your current location. And that's what you want. So it's that simple, but it's not obvious to me. So happy to share that tip.
I agree with you. And, you know, here's what I did before I went to Macworld, and I solved the problem kind of coincidentally, meeting all the criteria that you met there. So I didn't really fiddle with the device at all, except, no, I did do the same thing you mentioned I would have the device sync to the time server, and then it would automatically roll everything back on the calendar. But what I did is when I scheduled my events, so I would schedule them on iCal on my computer. And what I did is I would schedule them 3 hours earlier.
Okay. So you were doing the right, but you were setting it to 3 hours earlier. Oh, I see. So you weren't assigning the events a time zone when you scheduled them earlier. You were just letting them be in Eastern time, essentially.
Right. And to dig in a little bit here, and then I just noticed. So another option is that within iCal, there is a selection in advance called turn on time zone support.
That's right.
And what that does is it gives you an additional selection when you schedule an event that lets you indicate what time zone that event is occurring in. And I suppose that would have been the another way for me to schedule my Macworld appointments. What I did in my head was just, you know, so for example, I knew Cirque du Mac was starting at 8 Pacific. So I put it on the calendar because I had time zone support off on iCal, and I said it started at 11. So of course, when I got to California, it showed up on my calendar in the right time because the phone took care of it.
Okay.
As did iCal, because of course I did the same thing on my computer, is that with my computer, it would automatically set the time zone, and then it rolled back everything because I had time zone support off, and it rolled it back three. So I guess I got lucky that this all worked.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Cause that setting in iCal is a little misleading. When you have time zone support off, really what that means is I am going to assume that every event you enter is in the time zone of that your computer is at the moment that you enter it.
And that's what I did in my head. Again, right. I did the math. So yeah. I would do a 3 hour difference.
That's right. If you don't want to do the math, you can turn on time zone support in iCal. And then you just set the time zone. Now, if you had made the mistake of, say, setting Cirque du Mac at 8 p.m. and all your other meetings at the time that they were going to be, but you did it when you were in Eastern time and then you moved on over to California, that's when you would use this mail contacts calendars in the settings, and you would turn time zone support on, and you can, once it's on, you can force the time zone of your calendar only to be on East Coast time. So if you had made that mistake, then you would turn time zone support on, force your calendar to be on, you know, New York time, and then everything would be fine. Cirque du Mac would still be at 8 o'clock and all of that would work. So you can force your calendar into a certain time zone, and that's what that time zone quote unquote support is. It's a misnomer, but it's what it is, and it's always been that way in iOS. So
okay.
All right. We have another one from I believe a different Joe. And Joe says, I'm a longtime listener who occasionally gets a strange message saying another device on the network is using your computer's IP address. Try connecting again later. And then it goes on. What does it really mean? Have I been caught, Mr. Braun?
No.
Good.
I don't believe so. And here's what I think is happening. So, number one, if you don't know this already, so an IP address, first off, the IP address he was given is a 192 address. So that's a NAT assigned address or a non-routable address, which I assume is being issued by a time capsule or airport or similar device handing out DHCP addresses. Now I'm making that assumption. So One thing is that there are two ways to assign addresses. One is that you manually assign them to the devices. And when you set up a device, you can manually assign an IP address. And this is what people had to do in the old days before DHCP. One thing that could be happening is that the devices in general, all the devices on the network are set up for DHCP, but there may be one device for whatever reason, and I know the details, that may not be a Mac or I don't know why, but if it's set up to manually grab an IP address and maybe it grabs it manually and then the DHCP server tries to hand it out using DHCP, you'll get this message.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Because the network in general, the thing is that you cannot have two devices with the same IP address on the network. It's just a recipe for disaster.
It's a bad idea.
And every OS will prevent this. And it basically won't let you on. It'll say, hey, you're trying to get this address. Somebody already has it. Get lost.
But there was one time in a hotel where I realized that there was this one machine. This went on for days and days. This mm-hmm. one machine had a virus. It turned out to be a Windows machine. And it was blowing up the router every 60 seconds. It was forcing the router to restart. You can imagine that this is a problem for anyone in the hotel. So what I learned to do was I forced my IP address to theirs and I could blow theirs off the network for 24 hours, but I had to keep banging at it and finally it would work. But anyway, there's that. Because I knew the router was rebooting, so I knew I could get in. You know what I mean? Anyway, you're right. Yeah, you can't have more than one.
So one thing you could do, now if it's an airport, and depending on your router, it probably offers this feature, yep. but you could try to find out who is getting this address first. And at least on an airport, the way you do this on an airport is you run the airport utility.
The old airport utility.
Correct. Because I couldn't find, because I don't think this feature is available on the new airport utility.
This is a perfect classic example of the difference between the two. Yep, you're right.
So what you do is if you go to the airport menu, then you go to summary, there's going to be something that says wireless clients, which go with me here. It could be a wired client, but if you click on wireless clients, then it'll give you a screen that'll have a number of options. And there are two important ones. Well, the important one here, again, assuming DHCP, is called DHCP clients. And if you click on that tab in the old airport utility, I think 5.6 it now is called, it will show all the devices that have been given that have been assigned by DHCP, and it will give the IP address, the MAC address, which if you know the MAC address of your devices, and if you don't, you probably should, because that's going to help you with the next thing I'm going to suggest. But again, this table shows IP address, MAC address, client ID, which is an optional thing. Some devices will fill that in, like for example, my TiVo does. Or my TiVo adapter does.
Yep.
So that could also help you identify the device. Some devices will fill in the client ID, but it's not required. It'll show when the lease is assigned.
You can set that on your Mac. Sure. Yeah. If you want to make it easier for yourself, go into either Ethernet or airport in your. Let's see. Let me back up here. Sorry, John. System preferences, network, and then choose whatever your connection method is, Ethernet or airport. Hit advanced. Go to TCP IP, and that's where you can set the DHCP client ID. I always err on the side of not using spaces in that, because I used to use routers like a long time ago that freaked out at that. I think it's probably okay now, but I have, you know, old habits die hard, but that can show up. Some things don't read it right. Some routers don't. So it might not show up for you, but it can help you narrow down what computers what.
And the other thing that happens, and actually looking here, I believe at least the Mac fills that in automatically. Because what I see here is the client ID. I see two devices. One is called JB MacBook Pro, and one is called JB Mac Mini. And I don't recall filling in the client ID. So at least Macs will fill that in. And actually, I see two others here. I see TiVo dash and a big long number,
yep.
and iFi and a big long number, which looks to be a MAC address, or at least a part of it. So a lot of devices will fill that in. So maybe this table will help you figure out who's stealing this address. One suggestion that I have, and this is what I do on my network, just to avoid these sort of problems. So the way DHCP works is that there's a pool of addresses and it will hand them out. It'll set a lease time. And when the lease is over, it may hand it out to someone different. And usually it works just fine. But what I like to do is to assign a specific IP. Now, the problem, to back up here, the problem with DHCP is that whether you're on the internet as a whole or on a local network is that you may not always get the same IP address. And in some cases you may want to get the same IP address. You may want it to be predictable. if, for example, you need to connect to a network server and you need to type in the IP address and it doesn't have a name.
Right.
Here's the way to do that. And again, this is in the older, well, actually it's in the new airport utility. I'm going to refer to the old airport utility. And the way you would go about that is under, let's see, I believe it's internet, DHCP, and then there is a table here called DHCP reservations. And what you put in this table is two values. Or when you add a value, so here's what you do. So you can add a value, it asks for a description, and then you can reserve an address by either MAC address, which is what I prefer, but you could use the client ID. I prefer the MAC address because the MAC address can't easily be changed. It's always the same for every device. DHCP client ID, somebody could change it and then this won't work. So you choose MAC address and then you move on and you pair a specific IP address to the MAC address of a device. So what's going to happen here is that when that device comes on the network, it's always going to get the same IP address. And as we were discussing before, Dave, I do this not only for my own devices, but if I have someone come over, if I have someone who visits me more than once...
A regular, and they want, a recurring visitor.
A regular, yeah. Like, you know, my buddy Duffy or the parents or my sister or something like that. And they want to get on my network. I'm like, give me your device. I'm going to give you a MAC address. Or I'm sorry, give me your MAC address and then I will set up a DHCP reservation for you. So you'll always get the same one.
It's a handy thing. I used to do manual addresses that I assigned on my computers for my network. And the problem was if I had to take one of those computers to another network, I had to go in and reconfigure it to use DHCP. You know, and you can do it with locations and all that, but it's not automatic, at least not by default in the OS. So, you know, I had to go and do all this stuff. And the reservations are the better solution. As John explained, it's, you know, you get... the benefit of having the same IP all the time, it's a manually assigned IP, but you're manually assigning it at the server, which means that your computer's configuration can remain the same. And when you go somewhere else, it just works.
Right. Beautiful. Now, the other thought is I look at this screen, Dave, and DHCP, another thing in this screen is something called DHCP beginning address. Here's the other thing that I think may be happening. So if Joseph is already using DHCP reservations, the one thing I noticed, and maybe this is just, should have hit
mute
there.
Oh, I didn't hit mute. My apologies. Oh, I hit the wrong mute button. Sorry about that, folks.
Oh, yeah. Gross.
I know. I've been hitting it all the time. I misfired on that one. My apologies, everybody. Sorry, John. Please continue.
You may have to edit that out. The other thing, and, you know, people have actually said, well... DHCP beginning address is one value in this same screen. The thing is, Apple does not prevent you from putting a value in there that overlaps with DHCP reservations. And to me, that is a faulty implementation. I don't know if you agree with me, but other people have actually said that to us, saying, well, no, that should... I think devices should be smart enough, because what that means is that you could have the potential... for the DHCP server to hand out an IP address that's also a DHCP reservation. And I don't think that it should allow that. Or yeah. It should look at the DHCP reservations and set the DHCP beginning address, which is for machines that don't have a reservation, to a value that's outside of that. But for whatever reason, it allows you to let them overlap. And,
it does.
And that happened to me once where, I was unexpected things were happening because... the DHCP server was handing out an address which I had set for a reservation, and I was getting all confused until I set it above, and then everything was great. So it may be a manually assigned thing, or if not, dig in, like I mentioned, and find out what device is grabbing that address. It could be somebody that's just kind of wandering by and grabbing an address. I hope you have some sort of secure, and I don't want to assume this is wireless either. It could be a wired device. I don't know if there's a wired device somebody's plugging into your network and it's grabbing an address from DHCP. I don't know.
So it could be one other thing. And then we'll move on. It's if your Mac is sharing something, could be an iTunes library, could be file sharing, could be, you know, any number of things. If your Mac is sharing something and you have an airport router and you're running anything Snow Leopard or later, so 10.6 or later, something interesting will happen. Just as your Mac is about to go to sleep, it will hand off that sharing to the router. Now, that doesn't mean that your router is going to share your iTunes library. What it means is that while your Mac is busy sleeping and not answering network requests, your router will sit there and act as though it's your Mac answering those same requests. So if someone, and something very cool happens, if somebody says, hey, I want to talk to the iTunes library on the, on the iMac, and the iMac is sleeping, the router says, got it. It answers as though it is the iMac. So the other computer is none the wiser. It then sends a wake up request, a wake up over LAN request to your iMac, wakes that up, and then hands that off and stops answering as that. It's possible that what you're seeing here, Joe, is that your computer is seeing the router also acting as the computer based on its IP, and the computer saying, whoa, I can't use that IP. You know, if there's some holdover on the router, if the router thinks that the computer's still asleep, but the computer's not, that could be happening. And I've seen that once or twice, and we've seen that in different things. So that could be part of it. And if that's the case, it's not going to be solved by any of the things we've discussed, but it just is what it is. But if it's happening all the time, my guess is it's not that. You're not going to see it that often. Apple's kind of worked out most of the kinks there, but it will happen occasionally. So it's just worth noting. If you can't solve it, that could be the answer to the mystery. You know, John, we talk about console logs a lot when we're doing the show here. And listener Brian wrote in, it was actually in response to an answer that we had given him. He says, I've been hearing you talk about checking the console log a lot recently on your show, but I did not catch how to do that during any specific event. Can you tell me how? You want to tell them how to use the console there, John? Or shall I?
No, it's our little secret. No, I'm going to tell them. Well, the way that I do it, at least on my Snow Leopard machine, is I'll go to Spotlight and type console.
Oh, that's a
good way. That'll be the top hit. And actually, the Spotlight, though, it acts a little different on Lion, in that you have to type the whole thing out where it usually matches it on Snow Leopard. I've always been kind of annoyed by that.
Yeah.
But to me, that's the poor man's app launcher. So that's the usually the quickest way. And then I'll probably leave it running and you'll see it appear. And the thing I want to point out about console, and I think you suggested this, Dave, but I'm going to suggest a number of options here. So there are a few places you could look for messages. Now, one is all messages. And that's great because it's going to show you all messages, but you may not want to see that. Now, there is a way to filter the messages, and you'll see this in the upper right hand corner, and it says filter. And depending on what you're looking for, the sender of the console message could be the name of an application. It could be something kind of weird. It really depends. I'm looking right now in my console on my Snow Leopard machine, and I see Safari. That kind of makes sense. Firewall, that kind of makes sense. But then I see here something a little different. I see com.apple.kext cache. So you see things in one of two forms, either a single word or one of these something dot something dot something. And you just got to look at the console for a while to figure that sort of thing out.
Yeah, it is a good idea to take a look at your console when your Mac is acting normally, because you can kind of get a baseline as to what sort of messages are just going to kind of roll through here on a regular basis. And that'll help you to kind of provide your own mental filters of, okay, hey, wait a minute, this looks different. And like John said, using that string matching filter, that's a huge thing, because if you're trying to diagnose something with the drive, you know, you might try drive up there or disk or something, and if you notice in that sender column that there's a process that you want to watch, like, if you want to watch Time Machine, that process is called backup D. And so a great thing to do is to just filter down to backup D only. And then you're going to start seeing only Time Machine messages, and that kind of really helps, weed out the mess. So, yeah, there you go.
Right. And if you want to find problems, these are usually developers write these messages that they send them out as text messages. So if something's not going right, then if you search for something like error, fail, can't, or other similar negative words, you'll bring up, for the most part, messages that have to do with something terrible happening. Now, the other thing you can do is that, so there are a number of sections here. If you look on the left-hand side of the console, you may or may not see this list. If you don't, then there's going to be a button and it says show log list or hide log list. So if it says show log list, click on that and you're going to see a number of different logs. And one thing that you may want to do, so if you suspect a certain application is acting up here, rather than filtering, what you can do is go to, and there are two twisties or triangles, or I'm not sure what you call those little guys. It's a twist down. What do you call that, Dave?
A twist down. That's the new term. That's it. I like it.
And if you click on this next to either /library/logs or /library/logs, you will see a list of, for the most part, applications, or at least here. So I'm looking in library logs and I'll see Apple File Service, CCC, which is Carbon Copy Cloner, I assume, Crash Reporter, Diagnostic Reporter. So actually, most of those are system level. If you click on the one that's the tilde, which is your user directory, then you're probably going to see mostly applications. And I'm looking here and I see Drive Genius, Adobe, AIM, App Store, and some other things. So it'll look at either place. But if you suspect a certain application is acting up and you want to get messages that just come from an application, that's another way to filter it and make it more relevant as to what you're seeing.
Cool.
Got anything else?
No, I think it's time to go listen to Anthony here. Take it away, Anthony.
Hey, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. It's Gary from Indiana again.
I thought he said Anthony. I'm hoping that this is the right comment, and I just misheard him. Otherwise, we've got a random question that we're going to answer.
Longtime premium and regular show listener. Recently, I've been having a weird problem with my MacBook. It started when I was on Christmas break from school. When I was at my dad's house, I noticed that volume was reduced a little bit, and I checked all my volume settings, and they were good. But then as I did a closer inspection, I noticed that the sound was not coming out of the left speaker in my MacBook's built-in speaker. This is the MacBook Pro late 2009, and I'm under Apple Care, but it seemed to work fine when I initially plugged in my set of external speakers that I normally use when I return to my apartment. But just today, all of a sudden, the left speaker quit making noise. I have another Windows laptop right next to it that I use for the absolute occasions when I have to run a Windows program on the fly, or for some reason my Mac's doing something and I need to complete a school assignment. I plugged the speakers into that one, turned on a YouTube video, and both speakers work. Plugged it into my iPhone, same thing. I was wondering what you could recommend that I try. I've tried restarting the computer. I've done both a PRAM and SMC reset. And if I have to take it into the Apple Store during spring break, then I will. But I was just wondering what other things you could try to help me with this problem. I could do a nuke and pave if I absolutely have to, but I don't want to do that considering my iPhone screams at me every time I do, saying it's synced with another library, and then I have to make sure that I restore all my backups and everything before I do the initial sync. Thanks for the help, and keep up the good work.
So I don't think a nuke and pave is going to help, may hurt, as you pointed out. But you can try that, right? I mean, if you boot from the system DVD, and you should be able to use the volume up and down when you're in like Disk Utility or whatever to see what happens, and you can just put your ear down and you can tell right away if the stuff's coming out of both speakers. There are two things that are interesting to talk about here. Number one is there's little wires, and they're really little. I've personally broken these that connect to each speaker inside your MacBook Pro. So it's totally possible that one of these wires has just shorted out. They're kind of in a weird spot. Now, I mean, they shouldn't be moving around at all, but if you've been inside there, that's how I've broken them. That can do it. And then the other thing is, if your microphone is on, I believe on your machine, your microphone is situated right near your left speaker. And so Apple's actually smart about this. They turn off, like if you're in a speakerphone situation where you're talking and like iChat kind of thing, if you're doing that, or even Skype, I believe, is smart enough to do this. And I think it's a system level thing. If you're in a VoIP call kind of situation, it turns off your left speaker so that it doesn't have a speaker blasting right next to your microphone. And so it's possible that something has triggered that to happen all the time in yours. And that would be where potentially a nuke and pave would solve this. But you'll know that when you boot from the system DVD and just try adjusting your volume from there. And that'll tell you for sure. But, you know, otherwise, yeah, like you said, the SMC reset PRAM are the things I would try. John?
What about that MIDI?
Oh, yeah, dude, that could be it.
What is it? MIDI
audio. It's called audio MIDI. Audio MIDI. MIDI setup. It's in applications utilities called audio MIDI setup. That could totally be it.
Yeah, because I know we've had that come up before when output gets confused. So maybe.
Yeah, check built-in output there and see. It's going to list the channels in by number, but channel 1, I believe, is left and channel 2 is right. But you can obviously experiment and figure that out, too. But, that totally could be it. Yeah.
I'm with you on those small wires, though. The other small wires I ran into, Dave, and this was, I don't know if they do this anymore, but I had this where all of a sudden my MacBook Pro early 2008 started forgetting the time and date. Now, at least this vintage machine, aggravatingly enough, has, I think it's a PRAM or BIOS backup battery. It's a little 3-volt cell. And the thing is, it's hard to determine what Macs have this. And the thing is, even if it's in the machine, there's no way to read the voltage level on it. It's very infuriating. But I knew that this Mac had one of those. And actually what happened on mine is that the battery itself was not dead. But I think what happened is when I was in the machine, I may have jostled something or the wires are just fragile.
That makes sense.
The battery still had juice, but one of the tiny little wires had broken and this battery was not powering the circuit that remembered the time and date. So that's why every time I started up my machine or removed it from power, it then all of a sudden forgot. That was very upsetting.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of those wires are very tiny. And again, it could have been my fault. I could have been, you know, I try to be gentle in there. But no, it's buried beneath the CD drive. I didn't even get anywhere near it. I don't know.
Huh. Interesting. All right.
What are you saying to me here? Yeah, I got this.
Yeah, all right, go. Yeah, so Bruce had a comment. Take it away.
Wow. Oh my gosh, this is my stage debut here. I hope I don't blow it. Bruce writes, "Hi guys, in the last premium episode, you spoke about options in converting or moving iWeb sites. Here's a program that will convert from iWeb to WordPress. Amazing and cool." And what he found is something called from Rage Software, ragesw.com, called iWeb to WordPress. and it's $50. So if you use iWeb for blogging purposes, then this sounds like a tool you want to look at. $49.95. This sounds like a tool you may want to consider.
Cool. That almost qualifies as cool stuff found. I think we've talked about that before, but with you know, this iWeb thing coming to a head here, it's important that we get that right.
Well, we ask people, give us your thoughts about moving away from iWeb and MobileMe as your hosting service, and this is one of them.
Yeah, you want to address Daniel here now since it's kind of in the same topic realm.
Oh man,
Daniel had a question. You want me to read the question?
Oh, I see. No, I got it. I'm just flipping around here.
Okay, yeah.
All right.
We're handing the baton to John for some of this, and now John gets to see all the crazy stuff I have to do during the show. This is good.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to read through it here. So Daniel writes in, "Hi guys. Now that iCloud has lost the ability to use photo galleries and web hosting, can you recommend the easiest way to publish pictures with a password? And if not, what's the best way to publish a basic website, hosting suggestions, etc.? Sorry if you have covered this recently," which we did. I guess we'll end it there. I don't think I have to read the rest of this, do I?
No,
yes, I do.
I
see where you're going.
I think you're good. Yeah, I think you're good.
All right. And so what I wrote back, so yes, we did cover this in the last episode. And I mentioned that I am now, at least for the time being, a Flickr, or actually Flickr Pro fan. So right. If you're doing photos, then, you know, listen to the last episode and you'll find out all the reasons that I like Flickr. I guess the only thing I would add is that someone did advise me that you want to be careful. And I think with any of these services, so this is a general comment, I'm not going to rehash, but Flickr Pro, you have to pay for. There's Flickr Free and Flickr Pro. The problem is if you stop paying for Flickr Pro, you may lose access to some of your content.
Oh.
Well, what happens is that Flickr Free will only show you a certain segment of your content, or at least this is what one of my Twitter followers told me. And if you stop paying, then they kind of close the door a bit on you. They don't totally lock you out. But I guess my only caution is with any of these services. And it sounds to me in this case, what happened was this person stored their content exclusively on Flickr. So my advice to you is do not store your content exclusively. I would say with anybody. You know, don't store your all. And what I'm doing, I avoid that because all my content is stored in Aperture and I'm syncing it to Flickr. I'm not. Oh, gosh, I got to hit the mute key. There we go. You don't want to store with anyone because you don't know if they're going to go out of business or anything. So I'm syncing with Aperture. So all my content is situated in Aperture and I'm just pushing it out to a service and actually in a degraded format where it's not the full resolution. Now another one that I found, a number of other options. So one that was suggested by this person who brought up some of the shortcomings of Flickr is SmugMug. Now SmugMug, from what I can see, there is no free plan. They have a 14-day trial. I'm trying that out. And they offer, I think, three tiers of a pay service. And it looks pretty nice. I'm trying it out. I'm going to do the trial. And then another suggestion is that both Dropbox and SugarSync, and I think some of the other cloud services, and I think, Dave, I've been looking at some of these more in more detail, and I think you have as well. I think we may do a roundup or an evaluation of these guys.
From a photo sharing standpoint, you mean?
Well, no, I think just from a geek standpoint.
There you go.
Because I'm starting to learn about some of the differences. For example, SugarSync, I'm getting more of an appreciation for. They do some things that Dropbox doesn't. They're both good, but I think they have different intents and different audiences. But both Dropbox and SugarSync have special modes where you can store photos and people can visit your Dropbox or SugarSync site and view photos. I don't know if I recommend them because the other services are meant for sharing photos. These happen to do it. So if you already have Dropbox or SugarSync, you may want to look at that as an option to share your photos. If you just want to share things on a casual basis, I think both of those may be worth.
It makes it really easy. They've got like nice little, they both have nice web browser viewer kind of things to let you, you know, view photo galleries and that sort of thing. I will point out that you mentioned the differences, the kind of the geek differences between Dropbox and SugarSync. Really, from my perspective, SugarSync is probably all around a better solution simply because of how flexible it is. You can set folders to sync only to certain computers. You can set specific folders to sync as opposed to Dropbox where you're left with one. To me, the only benefit that Dropbox has now is that they were basically the first ones out. And so everybody has it. So I actually use Dropbox for sharing with others and SugarSync for all my own stuff, because I can configure better. But I've got this one shared Dropbox folder that's on all of my machines, and it's good for all the bands I'm in, and you and I use it, John, and you know, it's nice for that sort of thing. But as far as my own syncing from all my Macs for all my own personal data, I've been using SugarSync for over a year.
I'm with you. And actually and SugarSync, what kind of scared me with SugarSync was, so I synced it with one computer, and then I wanted to add another computer. So it understands the concept of what devices you have registered with it, whereas as far as I know, Dropbox does not really. And SugarSync let me sync a folder from one computer and then sync another the same folder. So actually I synced my documents folder from both my Mac Mini and my MacBook Pro to SugarSync.
Yep.
And at first I was afraid because I thought it would commingle them and confuse them all. And the thing is, that's more or less, from what I could see, an option. And that you can sync folder, it understands, all right, this is the documents folder on this computer, and this is the documents folder on that computer. and it keeps them separate. So I think I'm backing up what you're saying is that it's good as a individual syncing solution.
Right.
And that you don't have to sync at all, which I think Dropbox is meant for a different purpose or a different audience. And that, yeah, you and I use it to share the show notes because we have a shared folder. Well, SugarSync lets you do a shared folder as well.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
So I don't think I've done that. But Dropbox,
but
I think, doesn't...
it's not as easy. You know, if everybody already has Dropbox, it's like, well, you know, I don't want to ask everybody to install SugarSync. I just, you know, we'll use Dropbox. It's easier. Yeah, it's fine. Whatever.
Right. And both of them. Yeah. And actually, I just came off of a 30 gig plan with a SugarSync. And so now being a cheapskate with the 5 plan. And both them and Dropbox do offer a way where if you get other people to sign up, they'll give extra space. Well, they both offer a free level, and then they also offer extra space if you refer somebody.
That's right. So Dropbox's free plan is 2 gigs. SugarSync's free plan is 5. And if you use a referral code, so we'll put referral codes in the show notes and we'll put them for both Dropbox and SugarSync. If you use a referral code, Dropbox adds $250 to you and the person who referred you. So you can help yourself and help either John or I. And I've got a plan for this, John.
Because I was going to say, who's the linker?
Right. That's right. And then SugarSync, they double that. You get 500 megs, so half a gig for yourself just for using our referral code. So you start with 5.5 gigs. And then we also each get, you know, whoever you use gets 500 gigs, 500 megs, not 500 gigs, because that'd be awesome. So the way we're going to split this up is everybody on the left, you use John's code, and we'll put both in the show notes. Everybody on the right, you use mine. And that's how you split yourself up.
On the left of what?
You know, in front of us here in the audience, all of you on the left-hand side, you use John's code, and everybody on the right-hand side, you use mine. And if you're right smack dab in the middle, don't use either of our codes. Go ahead and use Michael's. If Michael has one, he'll put one in the AAC feed right here. And so there you go. So we'll have John's and mine will be in the show notes. And if Michael passes his along, we'll throw his out there too. So it's John on the left, Dave on the right. And for everybody smack dab in the middle here, then you know who you are. That's Michael.
I think in the show notes, I'm just going to say Dave's referral link and John's referral link. How about that?
Right. And they already know because they know where they sat for the show. All right, Bill. Save us, Bill.
So you got to send those to me because I don't know what yours are. And yes, I think I'm maxed out on Dropbox. I think we're both maxed out on Dropbox.
We're both maxed out on Dropbox, but you might as well use the referral code because you still get the $250 for yourself.
Oh, right.
And then if they ever open up, Dropbox maxes out your referrals at 10 gigs, and John and I are both maxed out at 10 because so many people have signed up with our codes. But we were also both maxed out at like 5 when they did that. And then one day they opened up the floodgates and said, you can go to 10. And we were automatically there because we had already had the referral. So it doesn't hurt to bank those if Dropbox ever decides to kind of raise the bar, which they might have to if SugarSync, you know, keeps up because they're good competition. But anyway, Bill, save us, Bill. Bill writes on a recent episode, I believe it was 375. You mentioned backing up purchase DVDs by using Ripit. Ripit is a great program, but it will not allow you to burn to a blank DVD. This can be accomplished by using Ripit along with Toast. Once you've used Ripit to make a copy of the contents of the DVD, highlight and right-click on the saved version of the DVD, scroll down to Show Content Packages. In there, you'll see the Video TS folder. It's that Video TS folder that you want to put into Toast, and then you burn that to a DVD, and it will work. He says, just a note, Ripit does not work on all commercial DVDs, but I've had 90% success with all the DVDs I have tried. Thanks, Bill. That's handy. That's good stuff. I'd forgotten, you know, I used to burn them back. He says he does it to save his original DVDs from getting damaged, which is something we used to do all the time when we use the DVD player in the car because, you know, DVDs that are floating around in the car just get the heck beat out of them. So we would do this and it worked great. But now with the kids, they've got iPod touches, so they rarely, they still sometimes use the DVD player in the car, but not all that often. So that's good. That's good. And in show 376, you know, we went through a painstaking process of describing how to remove LogMeIn and how it sometimes puts stuff out in weird places. And we talked about those weird places, not just for LogMeIn, but for other things. And Francois wrote, I was listening as you helped a listener uninstall LogMeIn, going through many loops, directories, and things. And I know that's rare on the Mac, but there is an uninstaller inside the application's LogMeIn folder for uninstalling LogMeIn. And it's, you know, it's the obvious stuff that sometimes is easy to miss when you go into geek mode immediately, like we do here, John. And he's totally right. You run the LogMeIn uninstaller and it pulls all that stuff out. So for apps like this, where they have sort of blasted things all over the place, see, because sometimes the developer's sensitive to the fact that they had to blast things all over the place, and they'll give you something to take it all out if you want to remove it. Which reminds me, because I want to remove LogMeIn from this computer here, and hang on, this is going to be really handy for me. So thanks, Francois. This is good. There's a LogMeIn folder. I've been fighting this for months. There it is. There's the LogMeIn uninstaller. That's it. I just run it. And are you sure you want to uninstall it? Unbelievable. It's asking me to authenticate. This is not smart, by the way.
Don't do this while we're trying to record. Stop.
Stupid. Hey, it worked. Better. It's totally gone. That's awesome. Thanks, Francois. Save my bacon. Cool stuff found. We have two from Greg, and I think it is the same Greg that sent in both of these. John, since you've been using Flickr, he wanted to recommend or re-recommend, as the case may be, Flickery, which is an app for a Mac app available for $5 in the Mac App Store. And it's a good app to manage and see and browse and manipulate your Flickr account. So there you go. That's cool stuff. Huh. Yeah. $5.
Yeah. I'm paying zero now.
I know. Well, yeah, that's right. You can use.
So I'm sure it offers more. Well, what Aperture offers is extremely basic, and that it's only syncing. So yeah, these guys do all sorts of other cool stuff. So,
What does it do? It's got like this whole kind of drag and drop manipulated. It looks like iTunes for Flickr, and you're just kind of doing stuff. So that's good. It says on their website that it's $9.99, but I was in the App Store earlier today, and it's $4.99. So if you're interested in getting it.
Really?
Try it.
Oh, yeah.
And you can try it free for 15 days if you want at their website, flickeryapp.com. But, if they're on some little short-term sale, you may wind up paying double if you wait.
I don't know. I'm looking here. So share and manage, browse and view, search and find, explore and enjoy. Oh, that's because Flickr offers an API, which of course is an application programming interface. So maybe that's a cool thing about Flickr is that, yeah, they allow third-party developers to build their... I thought this was a plugin. No, this is a standalone application. So, yep. All right.
Yeah. Okay. So...
What else did Greg have? Oh, well,
Greg had Clean App. He says, I know there are a lot of apps that will uninstall apps and all the files associated with them, like Apps, Zapper, etc. I've tried many of them, and I'm super impressed with one that I found called Clean App. It will actually log all the apps you install and keep good track of them. It keeps a very close eye on file operations. If you delete an app, it will ask you if you want to uninstall, so you click yes or no. Yes will bring up a window showing you all the files associated with it. And usually the list is very long and the files are in places that you'd never even think of checking. Kind of like we talked about before with that LogMeIn thing. I suggest you guys try it. I think you'll find it to be a keeper. It's from Cinium Software. And so we'll put that link in the show notes too. So thank you for that, Greg. And then lastly, this last bit of cool stuff found from Paul is sort of a note and a question. Let's see. Paul writes, I thought you guys might be interested in this email that I received from OpenDNS about something called DNS Crypt. He says, do you think it's going to make surfing on public Wi-Fi more secure as they suggest? So OpenDNS has this trial version, a beta version, I should say, of a Mac product called DNS Crypt. And the concept is, a lot of times, you know, you're out at a public Wi-Fi at Starbucks or perhaps even just kind of a mom and pop style coffee house or something like that, where they've got free public Wi-Fi. And there have been attacks in this regard, right, where somebody tries to hijack things or sniffs your packets and figures out where you're going and then tries to hijack your.
I did that somewhere else.
Right.
From a research standpoint only, of course. I was at the airport on their free Wi-Fi.
Right. Perfect example. Yeah. So they came up with DNS Crypt, and near as I can tell, I haven't used it enough to confirm all this, but my guess is, and they've released the source code for this, so presumably the community at large has kind of audited what it is they're doing. They are normally, when you go to a website, you know, you say, I want to go to www.macobserver.com. Your computer asks what's called a DNS server to translate that into an IP address. And then it goes to that IP address. So if the DNS server that you're using has been hijacked, it could redirect you somewhere else. Now, that's not horrible. I mean, it's pretty bad if it's MacObserver.com, but it's even worse if they hijack it for, say, Citibank.com. And now you're entering your banking credentials somewhere and you think that you're actually at Citibank.com and everything looks right. So this can be a real problem. When you're at home, you're using your local ISP's DNS servers, unless you've reconfigured things. But when you're out, you're using the DNS servers from whatever the coffee shop has defined. And while you can manually set your own DNS, it's still doing your Mac is still doing normal DNS lookups, which can be hijacked. The router, even if you say, I want to go to, you know, DNS server A, the router could still grab it and send you somewhere else. It's totally possible to filter those requests. So enter DNS Crypt. What this does is, anytime your Mac goes to make a DNS request, it actually makes a secure, it's not using SSL, but it's using a different secure protocol to go out and make a DNS request on a non-standard DNS channel to open DNS's servers. So you know that you're getting open DNS no matter what, and then it comes back and you know, translates it on your Mac and off you go. So it sort of sits in the way there. And anytime you do a DNS request, it goes out and does this encrypted thing. So A, you know you're getting what OpenDNS wants to return to you. And B, you know that no one else sees what your DNS traffic is, which can really be a cool security thing. So yeah, so thanks for sending that along, Paul. That's cool. I'm going to try it, John, because it's free. Why shouldn't we try it? Are you going to try it? Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I have this fear that we're going to have this audio issue in this show. And
no,
I
we won't.
Maybe
we
I
won't.
Lost you. No, I think we're getting close here.
Yeah, we could try it.
But don't try it right now, because it might hang us up.
No, not right now. But
my guess is installing DNS Crypt will cause your computer to reboot during that process.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, earlier in this show, you mentioned using Spotlight to launch the console, and you said that Spotlight's the poor man's launcher. And it's true, it is, and it works as a great launcher, and I use it, and you use it, John. But when I was at Macworld, I saw a lot of our fellow speaking brethren using various different launchers like Quicksilver or LaunchBar. And it's sort of, in a general sense, it seems like LaunchBar was kind of the chosen favorite. I'm curious what you listeners use, because I think that our lives could probably be a lot better using something other than just Spotlight to launch apps. I'm pretty sure of this.
Well, I have another one.
Yeah, go.
It's the dock. You've seen my dock.
Yeah.
It's a mess, but I arrange my icons in the dock and they make sense. So I have one section for browsers, one for office apps, one for music apps, one for iApps, one for movie players. It makes sense to me.
Sure. Yeah, but there's things that you can do, like, I watched somebody, I think it was Dan Frakes, who was doing a presentation in that rapid fire at Macworld Expo, where he was showing how you can open, like, you can use LaunchBar to tell, let's say you have a text file and normally it would open in text edit. You can actually tell the system, open this in BB edit without ever even, like, without having to do, you know, right clicking and all this stuff. It was a very seamless operation. So I gotta think that our lives are going to be better for this. And you can also customize stuff, which, of course, now that we're on Lion, you know, it's always coming up in alphabetical order only, and we don't have any flexibility, and it's like, you know, it stinks. So I think I'm going to try one of them. Probably going to be LaunchBar, but I'm curious what you folks use.
How about speech?
Yeah, good luck with that.
Speaking of speech, Dave, oh, I found something new today. I couldn't say anything, but Waze, you know the Waze guys.
Yeah.
This is actually kind of cool stuff found. So actually, I ran into one of their guys at Macworld, at one of the after event gatherings. And he actually knew us because we had mentioned him. And of course, you had sent a note out to him saying, hi, we mentioned you. He's like, oh, yeah, Dave wrote me a nice email. And he's like, here's a feature that's coming out, but I can't tell. But if I tell you, you can't tell anybody what it is until it's released. And today it was released.
Oh, cool.
So Waze, which is a crowdsourced traffic and navigation application that runs on an iDevice.
Yeah.
Probably an iPhone for the most part. Though I suppose you could run it on an iPad if you can mount it in your car.
Sure.
They just introduced a new, I think it's version 3.1. It now has two cool features. One is you can use the proximity sensor. So before, you had to punch the screen to enter and navigate. Now it has two things. One, if you wave your hand in front of it, kind of like Obi-Wan Kenobi, it'll activate a speech recognition feature.
Really? That's cool. That's good.
Well, the thing is that registering events, so what it does is you can enter events like there's a cop or there's an accident or something like that, but you have to momentarily look away from the road. Now, they make it as easy as possible, and I've done it when it's safe to do so, but still, if you could do it another way, and that's what they were thinking of. How can we innovate and do that? So one, I think they used the proximity sensor in the iDevice to determine when you're waving your hand in front of it.
Sure.
And then they activate a speech recognition feature. I haven't used it that much, but it's probably not perfect, but it's certainly better than you fiddling with a screen while you're driving.
Way, way better than fiddling with a screen while you're driving.
Yeah.
And can I rant a little bit here? We've had the Skype app for iOS out for a while, and it's cool. But of course, in order to accept a call, you have to have it running, and then that means your battery's dead in like 5 minutes. Yesterday, Vonage Mobile released a new version of their app, and it's actually pretty cool. This definitely qualifies as cool stuff found. So you sign up or you launch the app, and it says type in your cell phone number, and you do, and then it texts you a message so that you with a code so you can confirm that number's yours, right? And then the coolest part is you're done. You don't have to, like, if you wanted to contact me on Vonage Mobile, John, you already know how to do it because you have my cell phone number, and because you have my cell phone number in your address book on your iOS device, as long as you give Vonage Mobile permission to use your address book, it'll automatically see that I'm signed up, and you could contact me that way. And so they let you do audio calls and free texting using the app in between people. So your cell phone number becomes like your ID, but it runs in the background using the right things in iOS. So it does push notifications to alert you of a call, so you're not stuck with the stupid app running all the time listening for a call like Skype is. Hmm. So there's that, and that's cool, and you should use it because it's free, and you should check this out, folks. But my rant is, why in the world won't Apple let third parties, i.e. Skype and in this case Vonage Mobile, use the Bluetooth headset that's paired with your device? I've seen beta builds of similar software that can do it, but they can't publish it because it's a private API. But it's so stupid. I'd love to be in my car talking on Skype or Vonage Mobile and use my car's Bluetooth wireless. And you can't because it's a private API to do that. It's stupid. So there's my rant.
You know, that's what got me thinking. To me, using the proximity sensor for something that's not related to the phone operation, I'm surprised they were able to get away with it, but apparently they did. What I'm saying?
Yeah,
I do. And the proximity sensor, as far as I know, it's meant to make the use of the phone itself better, and that it knows whether it's smashed against your face,
right,
with you talking on the phone, or it's away, and then you can hit the hang up button, right? I think that's pretty much what the proximity sensor does.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
But these guys apparently were able to tap into it and use it for detecting a hand wave.
That's good. All right, so let's tell them how to find us quick, and then we'll wrap this one up. So you can email, and you especially can email premium@macgeekab.com.
I knew you would say premium@macgeekab.com, Dave.
That's what I said, premium@macgeekab.com. You can also call us 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That's right. You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. You can leave us iTunes comments, and you can find us on Twitter. John, tell them about Twitter.
Twitter is a service that... You know what Twitter is. If you don't, twitter.com, you'll figure it out. And you can find me at John F. Ron. You can find him at Dave Hamilton. You can find show notes and things about the podcast at Mac Geek Gab. You can find things about Mac Observer at Mac Observer. Pilot Pete, who is piloting somewhere, is Pilot Pete. And Michael Johnston, who does the AAC version, is Michael Johnston. And I think that's all the Twitter we have to tweet.
That's all the Twitter we have to tweet. That's right. And thank you, Michael, for all your hard work doing that AAC conversion each time. We appreciate it, and the listeners actually appreciate it even more. So big hand for Michael. Thank you, folks.
Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. Come over there. Like us. Love us. It's growing by leaps.
Every time I go to the page, there's more people who like us.
That's good. We also want to thank CashFly for all the bandwidth. It makes life easier for all of us. CashFly.com. And, John, I think that's as good as it's going to get this time around.
Yes, sir.
My apologies for coughing in your face earlier, folks. Thankfully, no germs were transmitted in the making of this podcast.
You could edit that out, you know.
No. We don't do any post-production here.
You could edit it out.
But if you did, you know, you start editing this stuff, and then you gotta be careful that you don't get caught.
Made up.